This episode contains strong language, pregnancy loss, and discussion of suicide. Please be advised.
Hello, hello. Why don't you come in? Can I get you anything to drink? It's so hot outside. It's the summer of 1962 in Brentwood, California. And Marilyn is a woman on a mission. She's invited a young reporter from Life magazine into her home to tell him what it's really like being her. She has her makeup done, her hair blown out, and she's wearing a simple black sweater with cropped yellow pants. Most importantly, she's on time. She knows people are gossiping about her problem with tardiness. And on occasion, yes, she stumbled out of her bedroom hours late, glassy-eyed, and too drunk to speak. But that's why she's made an effort to pull herself together and be punctual, to clear all of this up. And she's going to show the world how Fox completely mistreated her. Because once again, she's in a very public fight with the studio.
Why? Aren't they tired of losing?
No one's ever tired of losing to women. But this time's different. Marilyn's latest film shoot has completely fallen apart. Out of the last 17 days on her call sheet, she's missed 16 of them. So Fox has done something it's never done before. They fired her and slapped her with a $750,000 lawsuit.
They're not fucking around.
Nope. And now they're spreading stories about how emotionally unstable she is and totally impossible to work with. So Marilyn is going on a press counteroffensive. She wants the world to hear her side of the story. She was simply sick for a few weeks, and Fox overreacted. She's promised Life magazine at least 4 hours, and she's going to use all of them to make sure she wins this reporter over to her side. The reporter, a lanky man with oversized glasses, starts with some softball questions about fame. Marilyn responds with honest, thoughtful answers.
I like the stage here and now. Fame is fickle, and I know it. It has its compensations. It does, but it also has its drawbacks, and I've experienced those.
The reporter nods along, and Marilyn knows she's charming him. He didn't expect her to be this candid, this human. But as the interview drags into its second hour, and then its third, Marilyn starts to feel her nerves fraying at the edges. It's time for a little pick-me-up.
Say, would you like a drink? No. Oh, come on, have a little.
She pours herself a tall glass of champagne. She immediately feels lighter, more carefree. She's laughing more, and the reporter's laughing along with her. She pours herself another glass, and then another. Her thoughts speed up until she can't keep up with them. She keeps laughing, but the reporter's not laughing along anymore. She tries to remember what she wanted to tell him, something about how badly Fox treats her. She tries to explain, but she finds herself shaking with anger. At one point, the reporter asks how she cranks herself up for her acting roles, and Marilyn snaps.
I don't crank anything. You know, I'm not a Model T. Yeah, I don't crank. I don't know, but I think it's kind of disrespectful to kind of refer to it that way. We are not machines, no matter how much they want to say we are not.
The reporter looks stunned, hurt even, and Marilyn puts down her glass. She's lost control of the interview. She can't even remember what she was trying to accomplish. When the reporter finally reaches to turn off the tape recorder, she has one final plea for him.
Well, I hope we got something here. But please don't make me look like a joke.
From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. Over the last 3 episodes, the men in Marilyn's life kept trying to box her in. Joe DiMaggio wanted her to be a housewife, not a star. Daryl Zanuck, the head of Fox Studios, wanted her to play dumb blondes, even when she wanted so much more. And when Marilyn started her own production company to give herself the kinds of roles she craved, the press turned it into a joke. But if Marilyn wants to keep moving forward, she needs to confront her toughest critic yet, the one who still won't give her a moment's peace, herself. This is episode 4, The One and Only. It's 1956, 6 years before Fox will fire Marilyn and she'll go on a counter campaign in the press. After an awful experience shooting The Prince and the Showgirl with Laurence Olivier, Marilyn is so done with London Town. She's over tea time and ready to order up some black coffee instead. She's heading back to New York City, and her husband, Arthur Miller, is coming with her.
Why is she still with this bonehead?
I don't know. After she found his notebook, she was devastated, heartbroken. She confronted Arthur, and there was a lot of fighting.
I mean, what can he even say in his defense? His hand slipped and accidentally wrote the words bitch?
I mean, I don't know what he said, but whatever it was, Marilyn decides to give him a second chance. She just isn't ready to throw in the towel on her third marriage, the one that she had hoped would give her the family she always dreamt of. She really wants kids, and she wants them with him. She's going to do whatever it takes to save their marriage.
So, couples therapy, I hope.
No, God, they do it the healthy way. They bury all their feelings deep down and decide to never talk about the notebook incident again.
Almost as good as having a baby to save a relationship.
Right. The plan to fix their problems is simple. Marilyn's going to make Arthur her number one priority. She's going to do the one thing she wouldn't do for Joe DiMaggio. Become a housewife. In order to be a housewife, they need a home. Before they tied the knot, Marilyn and Arthur never had their own place. Not together. He was married to someone else, and it all went so fast after he got divorced. It was like a whirlwind. He proposed, she said I do, and they were off to London. They lease a 4-bedroom apartment on the Upper East Side, and Marilyn throws herself into decorating the place. She starts with Arthur's writing room. She fills it with lots of bookshelves and a sofa. The rest of the place is movie star modern. At least that's what one biographer calls it. She paints the walls very white, and the floors are covered in white carpet. She hangs a black and white portrait of herself in the living room. It's Arthur's favorite. And she puts lots of mirrors up on the wall. But her main focus is to make sure Arthur's happy. Marilyn wakes up early to make him breakfast. She makes sure the staff is quiet while he works. Not a peep.
God forbid they disturb the delicate genius.
She only bothers him to bring him coffee. And things do seem to be getting better for them.
I mean, of course they are. He has a servant, not a wife.
Great point. But this is also very therapeutic for Marilyn. She's healing during this time. In London, her nerves were completely shot and her anxiety was through the roof. Now she's taking a break from the movie biz and getting some much-needed R&R.
How is being an in-home barista the same as getting R&R?
Well, she's discovering things that make her happy, too. Like their new basset hound named Hugo, whom she adores. She and Arthur take him for long walks in the city and on Long Island, where they run a cottage house. And it's dreamy there. They swim in the ocean and go on drives. Marilyn goes horseback riding and paints with watercolors. She takes up gardening and discovers she has a green thumb. She also dives into building a relationship with Arthur's family. She gets super close with his parents. She starts to call his father Dad and spends hours in the kitchen with his mother learning to cook borscht and matzo ball soup. And she works extra hard to make Arthur's kids from his first marriage feel comfortable and wanted. Marilyn knows what it's like to feel abandoned, so she goes out of her way to make sure they never feel that way. She's the opposite of the evil stepmom. When she finds out that Arthur's son never had a big birthday party, Marilyn fixes that. She plans a huge blowout extravaganza and tells her stepson to invite everyone he knows. Overall, Marilyn's feeling good about things. Their relationship is stronger. She's a lot less anxious. And she's got all this new family to love. But there's one thing that's still missing. The reason she forgave Arthur and gave the relationship another shot. She's yearning for her own children. She starts fertility treatments at Doctors Hospital in Manhattan. And it pays off. In June 1957, Marilyn discovers she's pregnant. She's ecstatic. She can't wait to put her design skills back to work for the nursery. It's August 1st, 1957 in Long Island, and Marilyn's outside in the hot sun. She's kneeling in the grass and holding shearing prunes. She cuts a rose and brings it to her face to smell. She thinks to herself how funny it is that it's summer, but in her mind, it feels more like spring. She loves being pregnant. It makes her feel connected to the future in a way she's never felt before. In her mind, she sees herself holding a baby girl 7 months down the road. She's sure she's having a girl, even if the doctors haven't confirmed it yet. And she's telling this baby girl how much she's loved and how special she is. Marilyn plans on saying these things to her every day to make sure she knows it. She's determined to give her daughter everything she didn't have in foster care. Unconditional love and self-esteem. She can't wait to hold her and keep her safe. Marilyn picks up her shears and cuts another flower when suddenly she feels a sharp pain. She drops the shears and reaches for her stomach. Marilyn cries out for Arthur. Marilyn is terrified and in pain, but she only wants to see her own doctor. The ambulance drives over 2 hours to Doctors Hospital in the city. And the whole way, Arthur holds her hand as she prays that everything's going to be okay. But it's not. Her doctor tells her that the pregnancy is ectopic. It's developing in her fallopian tube, not in her uterus. And that it's fatal for the baby and for Marilyn. She has no choice but to undergo surgery. When Marilyn wakes up, she's completely shattered. And over the 10 days she spends in the hospital recovering, she only feels worse. She can barely look at Arthur, who won't leave her side, because when she does make eye contact, she's ashamed. She feels like she failed them. Her body couldn't keep their baby safe. And she really believes it's all her fault. After leaving the hospital, Marilyn returns to her Manhattan apartment. She enters her bedroom, closes her blackout curtains, and goes to bed. But she doesn't want to get up. Being asleep is so much better than being awake. Because when she's up, she can't help but remember everything that happened. She looks down at her body and knows that her baby is gone. Marilyn starts taking more and more sleeping pills. The woman who came back from London ready to fix her marriage and embrace life is long gone. She no longer wakes up early to make Arthur breakfast. Now she sleeps well past noon. And when the maid hears her stir, she brings her an egg, but Marilyn demands a Bloody Mary, which she washes down with champagne.
I mean, you can't blame her.
No, it's bleak. Sometimes she'll get a little bit of energy and want to talk on the phone. And you'll never guess who she calls. Her ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio.
Okay, I would not have guessed that.
Even after their divorce, Marilyn and Joe stayed friends. He's one of the only people in her life that she truly trusts. She doesn't feel like he has some ulterior motive. He doesn't need her money, and he definitely doesn't want to glom onto her Hollywood fame. She knows for a fact he's not using her. And she can't say the same about her husband, Arthur. Lately, his career hasn't been going well. In fact, he hasn't written anything great in years, which means he's not making much money. Whatever he does earn goes to alimony and child support. So Marilyn has been supporting the lifestyle he's grown accustomed to. And she's starting to feel that he's just with her for the money. Their relationship is barely hanging on. Marilyn's barely hanging on. Between the depression and the paranoia, she starts to feel like she's going crazy. She even starts to think that she hears voices in her head. And that scares the shit out of her. Because it reminds her of her grandmother and her mom, who were both locked away in mental institutions. And her biggest fear is that she inherited their mental illness. Marilyn's in such a dark place and spiraling so much that she takes some extra sleeping pills one night. and she washes it down with long sips of champagne. As she's in and out of consciousness, she calls for Arthur. When he sees her labored breathing, he knows it's not good. He calls a doctor, who luckily gets there in time to pump her stomach. This overdose scares Marilyn. She knows that she can't go on like this. Something needs to change fast. She realizes that it's time to return to work.
Out of the frying pan.
If she's not ready to tackle the bigger issues head on, then this will at least give her a reason to get out of bed. She just hopes she can pull herself together enough to make it seem like she's not a complete wreck. It's summer 1958 in Los Angeles. Marilyn's wearing a silky robe. She looks sleepy as she enters the bedroom. She rummages around a couple drawers and asks, "Where's the whiskey?" "Cut!" yells Billy Wilder, the director of her latest film, Some Like It Hot. Marilyn's body stiffens. She knows she messed up the line, and it's not the first time. She just can't seem to get "Where's my bourbon?" out of her mouth. This is take 23.
Well, if it's anything like our Christmas photo shoot, they're just getting started.
Oh man, flashbacks. She looks at her co-stars, Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis, who are dressed in drag, and they look like they're more than ready to take off the heavy makeup and uncomfortable clothes. They are not thrilled that Marilyn is taking so long. She thought getting back to work and a change of scenery would do her good, but all the baggage just came with her from New York. She's still depressed and fighting with Arthur, and she's still taking pills and drinking to cope with that. In fact, she keeps a thermos on set that's sometimes filled with vermouth and other times vodka and orange juice. So it's no surprise she's having some trouble remembering things. Wilder has crew members hold up cards with her lines on them so she can read off them as they shoot. And her choreographer does the dance number just off camera so she can follow along.
It takes a village.
Yeah, Marilyn's completely embarrassed. And today might be one of her worst days yet. But Marilyn isn't giving up. The perfectionist in her is still there. Wilder tells her to go back to her mark and start over. He calls out, "Action!" Marilyn rummages through the drawers again. And this time she says, "Where's my bonbons?" "Cut!" As the story goes, Marilyn does this scene 83 times until she gets it right. But boy, does she get it right. Marilyn's performance in Some Like It Hot sizzles. It's incredible. Each time the crew views the footage from the previous day, they're amazed and perplexed. Every day they're watching her struggle her way through the scenes, but in the footage they're seeing, she's mesmerizing. While real-life Marilyn is battling demons, the on-screen Marilyn is magical. She just has this undeniable movie star quality that the camera loves. She knows her angles, and even though she flubs her lines, she still has perfect comedic timing. And it's not just the people who are making the movie with her who are wowed by her performance. When Some Like It Hot opens, it's a huge hit. It becomes the number one film in the country and stays in that spot for 3 weeks. On week 4, it finally gets bumped off. But then it comes back into the number one spot for another 4 weeks. It's a juggernaut. And people credit Marilyn for its success. Variety says, "Marilyn has never looked better. She's a comedienne with a combination of sex appeal and timing that just can't be beat."
Wow. The similarities between us are just endless.
Truly. And over the years, Some Like It Hot has only become more beloved. The American Film Institute lists it as number one on their 100 funniest movies of all time. And Marilyn even nabs a Golden Globe for her performance. But all of this praise is shrouded in a dark storm. Marilyn's world is imploding. On December 19th, 1958, Marilyn suffers a miscarriage. During filming for Some Like It Hot, she discovered she was pregnant again. She was thrilled, but her doctors were worried. They told her to stop taking barbiturates and cut out the drinking. And Marilyn wanted to, really wanted to, but she just couldn't. As if she didn't blame herself enough for the first loss, this loss is twice as heartbreaking. She's completely devastated, and her pain just leads to more pills and booze. And it gets worse. Marilyn's also having lots of marital problems. She and Arthur fight all the time. And when they're not yelling, they completely ignore each other. One of their maids says they'd sit at the dinner table in complete silence.
I mean, turn on a TV at least.
But there's one thing that they still talk about with some civility. Arthur's been writing a screenplay called The Misfits. He started it not long after they were married. He says it's an opus for her, a love letter. He always pictured her starring in it. And now it's been greenlit. Marilyn hopes that doing this film together might fix all their problems. They'll be working alongside each other day in and day out. And as everyone says, the best way to work on your marriage is to work on a film with your spouse. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes.
When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss.
Yeah.
And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. It's August 1960 at the Mapes Hotel in Reno, Nevada. It's nearing 10 p.m., but both Marilyn and Arthur are still wide awake. Arthur's writing with one hand and holding a cigarette in the other. Marilyn paces the room and wrings her hands. "Are you almost done?" she asks. Arthur takes a quick puff. "Not yet, not yet." Since production started on The Misfits, every night has been like this. One rewrite after another. And mainly on Marilyn's character, Rosalind. In the first draft, Rosalind was an educated woman from the East Coast. But Arthur scratched that and made her a high school dropout. Marilyn found it curious and wondered if it's because she herself didn't finish high school. But she shrugged it off because why would Arthur do that? Then, Arthur's next revision was to give Rosalind a new backstory, a sordid and shameful one, full of failed love affairs. Marilyn, again, found it strange because, well, he's made comments about her history with men and how it makes him uncomfortable. Like when they went to a party, he wondered how many of the men there she'd been with. With every change in the script, she's starting to feel more and more like the character is transforming into her. But she's just hoping that she's wrong about this. Arthur puts out his cigarette. "I'm done," he announces. She grabs the new pages and flips through them. Her face goes pale as she sees how much he's simplified her lines. To put it bluntly, he's completely dumbed Rosalind down. Marilyn's hands shake as her fears about life imitating art intensify. She's still not 100% sure, but if she's right, and Rosalind is turning into the mirror image of herself, then it's clear what Arthur really thinks of her, that she's dumb too. She's determined, but also completely terrified to find out if her instincts are right. Marilyn's had horrible shoots before. To be fair, almost every shoot is horrible for Marilyn. She has panic attacks and over-medicates and struggles to get her insecurities under control. But this shoot is different because it's becoming clear that this film is about her struggles and insecurities. Arthur's now putting conversations they've had word for word into the script. He once told her she was the saddest girl he'd ever met. Now, he's giving that same line to Clark Gable, who plays her love interest.
What makes you so sad? I think you're the saddest girl I ever met.
So Marilyn can't deny it anymore. Arthur's using this film as his own couples counseling session. He's getting out all his complicated feelings about her. How sad and frustrating he finds her. How impossible it is to be married to someone like her. When you get to the Misfits' most pivotal scene, it's like listening to a ticker tape of Arthur's worst thoughts. Rosalind screams like a madwoman in the distance, and the three men in her life watch her unravel and talk amongst themselves.
I pity you! You three dear sweet dead men!
She's crazy.
What's that?
They're all crazy. You try not to believe it because you need them. She's crazy. You struggle, you build, you try. You turn yourself inside out for them. But it's never enough. So they put the spurs to you. I know, I got the marks.
Love it. Marilyn's character screams while men call her crazy. Classic.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn later says, I guess they thought I was too dumb to explain anything. So I have a fit, a screaming crazy fit. I mean nuts. And to think, Arthur did that to me. She feels so betrayed. Her husband's telling everyone exactly what he thinks about her. The entire set knows, and soon the entire world will know too, just how much Arthur Miller resents Marilyn Monroe. By the middle of the shoot, Arthur and Marilyn have separate hotel suites. And by the time Arthur writes Fade to Black, their marriage is over.
One afternoon in February 1961, Marilyn opens her window and spends a long time looking down. She's been back in New York for a few months, but she still doesn't feel like herself. She's hollowed out during the day and taking pills by the handful at night. No matter how many she takes, she can't sleep. She recalls reading somewhere that when people fall from heights, they actually lose consciousness before they hit the ground. Even a moment of oblivion sounds nice. It would be so easy to just let herself fall. She looks down at the pavement 13 floors below. Nothing's stopping her. She swings one leg over the ledge, then another. But then she sees a woman walking down the sidewalk. She knows that woman from the building. She recognizes her brown dress. They always have nice chats in the elevator. Marilyn thinks, if I jump now, I'm going to splatter all over that nice lady. She can't do that to her neighbor. Marilyn snaps out of her trance, steps back inside her apartment, and closes the window. At her next therapy session, Marilyn acts out the entire scene. Her desire for oblivion, the 13-floor drop, her second thoughts. Marilyn's pale with the memory of what almost was, and her therapist is shaken. Marilyn, she says, you can't go on like this. Marilyn nods. She knows. So when her therapist suggests a supervised stay at a hospital, Marilyn agrees. She imagines a high-end facility where she can feel safe, maybe even a little bit pampered. Her therapist drives her to the hospital herself, and Marilyn tries to feel hopeful. Maybe this is the change she needs. But the moment Marilyn checks herself in, she knows she's made the wrong decision. Nurses gruffly take her by the arms and escort her down one long anonymous hallway, then another. No other patients are in sight. With each turn, Marilyn's sense of dread grows. Finally, they stop and open a door to a small room, no bigger than a cell. They push Marilyn in and close the door. She tries the handle. It's locked.
She looks around, takes in the bare walls, the barred windows. She's seen rooms like this before. Her mother's been in and out of psych wards all her life. Marilyn's worst fear has always been ending up somewhere like this. And now she's here.
Honestly, it sounds more like a prison than a psych ward.
It does. And she thought the hospital would be like a celebrity rehab facility, like a spa with doctors. She didn't think her therapist would send her to a place with literal scratch marks on the walls and people screaming to themselves up and down the hall. Over the next few days, Marilyn tries to suppress her growing panic. She needs to figure out how to get herself out of here before she loses what little bit of sanity she has left. She racks her mind. She's not allowed to have any visitors. She can't make any phone calls. She's gonna have to get creative. She asks herself, if this were an improv class, what would I do?
Drop $500 for some basic white guy to tell you what comedy is?
Yes, and. Then she remembers a cheesy B-movie she made early in her career. She played a troubled young woman who held a razor to her own neck and threatened to hurt herself. Channeling that desperate girl, Marilyn picks up a chair and hurls it at the door's glass window. But it doesn't break. It's too thick. Marilyn's not ready to give up. She throws the chair at the window over and over again with all her strength. Finally, a small shard of glass breaks off. She's got her razor blade. When two doctors rush into the room, Marilyn holds the piece of glass to her neck. She threatens to hurt herself if they don't let her out. But the doctors say they can't let her go. So she holds the glass even closer to her neck and screams, "If you're going to treat me like a nut, I'll act like a nut." Whatever Marilyn intended is not what happens next. The doctors tackle Marilyn and carry her face down and sobbing to the seventh floor. If she thought her floor was bad, this one is 100 times worse. It's where the more violent patients are housed.
Fuck.
For 3 days, Marilyn's confined to a padded cell. Sometimes she's even forced to wear a straitjacket. They only take it off when she's sedated, and even then they restrain her arms. Finally, after 3 days of sheer hell, a sympathetic nurse lets Marilyn use the telephone, and she calls the one person she trusts the most, Joe DiMaggio. When he hears where she is and what's happening to her, he immediately hops on the first flight to New York. He barges into the hospital and demands they let Marilyn out this instant. When the nurses explain that's not how it works here, he loses his shit. He yells, "If somebody doesn't get her out of here, I swear to Christ I'll take this hospital apart brick by brick."
Okay, I'm not a big DiMaggio fan, but really loving his energy right now.
Agree. And it works. The next day, Marilyn's discharged. Joe encourages her to check herself into Columbia Presbyterian, the kind of hospital she originally thought she was going to, one where she's allowed visitors and even gets to go out to lunch from time to time. And Joe promises to stay nearby on call whenever Marilyn needs him. For the next 3 weeks, Marilyn rests up in a hospital room overflowing with flowers and get well soon cards. When Marilyn checks herself out on March 5th, 1961, she's looking like herself again. A mob of reporters thrust microphones into her face and push her left and right. But she smiles for the cameras. One reporter asks her how she's feeling, and she beams, "I feel wonderful, thank you." I'm guessing she probably doesn't feel wonderful.
I mean, if it's anything like I felt on Cinco de Mayo 2006, she's a saint for even being able to stand.
Okay. Well, Marilyn's ready for a fresh start. She's hit rock bottom. And now she's ready to take her pickaxe and climb her way back up to the top. And she's gonna do that in the one town where you can climb all the way up to the stars, Hollywood.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule.
You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com.
We know you have your tried and true closet staples, but it can be fun to switch it up. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada.
Yeah, it's easy to find instant inspiration at Saks.com. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or bright Chloe blazer for brunch.
Okay, well, obviously this is making me just want to shop after we record this.
I know, and it doesn't take much for me wanting to shop. No. So. But if you're looking for a joyful shopping escape, which we all are,
yes,
then head to Saks.com for inspiring ways to shop for everything on your agenda.
Saks.com. It's April 1961. Marilyn's back in Los Angeles, determined to move forward with her life and stop taking everything so seriously. Her life in New York was all about enlightenment and growth. It was about literature, Broadway, and culture. She's proven that she can hang with the smartest people and make some prestigious films. Now, Marilyn just wants to simplify things. She wants to find things that, as Marie Kondo would say, spark joy. For starters, she falls in love with a Spanish-style house in Brentwood. It's modest, but very private. And she tosses out all of her black, white, and beige clothes.
Kanye would blow a gasket.
Yes. And much like Kim, she fills her closet with brightly colored items. We're talking fuchsia, hot pink, lime, orange, tons of Pucci dresses. And she goes to the Beverly Hills Hotel and asks the hairdresser to just give her a new hairstyle. She says, "Do me any way you want. I don't care."
Feels riskier than Russian roulette, but okay.
Yeah, I could never. And he goes really short and teases it. Marilyn loves the new cut. And she's so tired of talking only about the news and the latest Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. So she starts to hang out with people who really know how to have fun. The Rat Pack. As in Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, and Frank Sinatra. They are the epitome of a good time. She also starts dating again, but it's casual. She's on and off with Sinatra, who's one of the only men around who can match her level of star power. And when that fizzles out, she has a weekend tryst in Palm Springs with the one man who might be even more famous than Sinatra, the President of the United States.
And there's JFK.
Mm-hmm. But it's just a good time, not a serious love affair. They drink too much, and she calls up her personal masseur so he can walk her through how to massage the president's back. Later, when her masseur asks her how the weekend went, she laughs. "Well, I think I made his back feel better."
I bet she did.
Marilyn's trying to make her life fun again. She wants some lightness and joy after the past couple years. But that doesn't mean she's in denial. She knows that she also has a lot of darkness that she needs to deal with. Marilyn's enlisted Dr. Ralph Greenson to help her tackle her demons. He's known as the psychiatrist to the stars.
Okay, but does he have his own radio show on KACL like Frasier?
No, he doesn't. But Marilyn has high hopes. She thinks that with his help, she'll soon be as happy inside as she's starting to be outside. Dr. Greenson diagnoses Marilyn as manic depressive. Today, it's referred to as bipolar personality disorder, which is why she suffers from huge mood swings. One minute, she'll be on top of the world, and the next, she feels like she's literally free-falling towards Earth. Being diagnosed with mental health issues is really hard on Marilyn. She's always been terrified of this, that she'd inherited it from her mother. But now that she knows,
Marilyn and her doctor can strategize and make a plan. They can hopefully find a way for Marilyn to cope with it and keep her from getting locked in an institution again. The problem is, medicine isn't as advanced as it is today. Antidepressants aren't really a thing yet and not readily available, not even to celebrity doctors and one of the most famous women in the world. So it's back to relying on tranquilizers and sleeping pills to battle against the depressive episodes. Marilyn's trying hard to get help, but she's hitting a very hard wall. And just in time for her to get back to work. It's April 10th, 1962. Marilyn's at the Fox lot for pre-production on her latest film, Something's Got to Give. She's here for wardrobe tests. Marilyn tries on some slinky costumes. She parades back and forth for the camera. And like always, it's magic. She's radiant. The director and the producers see the footage and can just feel they have a hit on their hands. And the brightness in her eyes makes them confident that she's strong enough mentally and physically to begin shooting.
Okay, except I don't really think that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. Marilyn's outward appearance does not reflect what's happening inside. She may have changed her hair and now wears brighter, more fun dresses, but internally, she's still a ball of anxiety and emotionally a wreck. She and Dr. Greenson haven't figured out how to deal with her manic depressive episodes. On day one of filming, Marilyn is a no-show. She calls in sick. She says she has sinusitis. On day two, she calls in again. Insomnia. On days three through five, she says she has a virus. And it keeps going. Some doctors who have studied Marilyn think that her ailments during this time are psychosomatic. Marilyn's anxiety and fears are manifesting themselves so deeply that they're causing her to be physically ill. It's like when she'd get hives and hide in her dressing room. Just now it's gotten worse and more debilitating. Fox and the producers don't get it. All they see are dollar signs. Every day she's out is a big hit to the budget. And after missing 16 days of the 17-day shoot, Fox is at their breaking point. Marilyn knows she's in big trouble. She's got to pull herself together and get well. But first, she's got to follow her heart, because it's also in need of repair. It's May 19th, 1962, at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Marilyn is moments from performing. She's wearing a white fur coat over a tight-fitting gown. Her platinum, almost white hair is blown out with her bangs swept to one side. She looks radiant and like she spent hours getting ready, because she did. She's determined to wow the hell out of the President of the United States. They haven't seen much of each other since their rendezvous in Palm Springs, and lately he's been more distant. She hadn't entered the affair with any expectations, but she can't stand the idea of losing him right now. Not when she feels like her career is in shambles. So she's got to go out there and show him what he'll be missing if he calls it quits. Just then, she hears her cue. The actor Peter Lawford is introducing her. As Marilyn takes the stage, the crowd goes wild. Lawford can't even finish his sentence. Marilyn thinks, well, that's a good start. JFK will see how everyone else in the audience wants a piece of her. And if that doesn't give him second thoughts about calling things off, she has one more trick up her sleeve. Or, really, under her coat. She removes her fur and reveals the sexiest dress that anyone has ever seen. It's skin tone to give the illusion that she's naked. There are 2,500 crystals hanging on the fabric, which makes her skin look like it's sparkling. And it fits her like a glove. She's literally been sewn into it.
That'll make for some fun foreplay.
I hope he brought his scissors. But Marilyn isn't done. She looks directly at JFK, and as though no one else is in the room.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President, happy birthday to you.
She sings the most provocative way she knows how. With every breath, it's like she's seducing the microphone.
In other words, how we record every day?
Yeah, my mic's down my throat. And much like me, Marilyn knows the power of sex. She's used it time and time again to get ahead. It's what made her famous. She's never hidden her body. She's always flaunted it, and it's paid off. So she caresses her body and motions for an oversized cake to be carried out by four men. The audience breaks into applause, and JFK takes the stage.
Thank you. I can now retire from politics after having had a happy birthday sung to me in such a sweet, wholesome way.
She knows that's dripping in sarcasm, which means she delivered exactly the message she intended to. Now, she just hopes it works. Sadly, Marilyn's trip to New York backfires on a number of levels. It doesn't make JFK want to rekindle their relationship. The performance was so over the top that their super private affair is now super public. Everyone's speculating that they're sleeping together. One columnist writes, "It seemed like Marilyn was making love to the president in the direct view of 40 million Americans." And that's not a good look for the married leader of the free world. Jackie Kennedy is mortified and pissed. JFK has no choice but to further distance himself from Marilyn. Marilyn's never had her sex appeal backfire like this. And she's hurt. This is not at all how she saw it playing out. But it gets worse. Fox is pissed that Marilyn took off work to fly across the country and perform. She's missed so many days because she was sick and then basically took a vacation. At least that's how they see it because it's costing them money. When she gets back to set, she says she's exhausted and can't shoot close-ups. And then a couple days later, she calls in sick with an ear infection. Fox is at their wit's end. Which brings us back to when they slap her with a $750,000 lawsuit and fire her. When word gets out, the press takes her to task. One headline reads, "Marilyn to be replaced. Is she finished?" And the director of the film says, "I believe it is the end of her career. She wants to do the picture, but she has no control of herself. Her performance is not good. It's as though she's acting underwater." Marilyn begins to spiral. It's all falling apart. She pushed JFK completely out of her life. She's no longer welcome at the studio, and her career might be completely over. She even hears through the grapevine that Fox has already found a young blonde actress to replace her in Something's Gotta Give. They're already altering Marilyn's costumes to fit her. Marilyn feels alone and abandoned. It brings back all the feelings she had as a kid. Nobody wants her. Even when her co-star Dean Martin says he won't work with anyone but her, and Fox once again changes its mind and says they want her back, it's not enough. She turns to the only thing she knows will numb the pain: booze and drugs. Dr. Greenson's been trying to wean her off of some of her barbiturates, but now she's desperate to reverse course. She wants the oblivion that only drugs can give her. When her doctor refuses to prescribe them, she finds another doctor who will, and then another. Dr. Greenson tries to chase down all her new doctors to keep track of what she's taking, but there are just too many. On August 5th, 1962, Marilyn Monroe is found dead in her Brentwood home. The coroner's report says she died of acute barbiturate poisoning, ingestion of overdose, and added that it was a probable suicide. Some friends of Marilyn's believe that she didn't intend to kill herself. She'd just combined the wrong pills and forgotten how many she'd taken, which had happened many times before. Others believe that her despair had just become too much for her. And others believe there was foul play, that the Kennedys had her bumped off to keep her from talking. But that's a whole other podcast that I'm very willing to do. We'll never know for certain how Marilyn Monroe died, but we know how she lived. She was a woman ahead of her time. She fought to be paid what she was worth. She started her own company.
she refused to apologize for enjoying her sexuality. But in the 1950s, before the sexual revolution and the women's liberation movement, Marilyn often stood alone. And alone is a hard place to be, especially for a traumatized foster kid who never felt like she truly belonged. But beyond what Marilyn represented in society, she was an artist. And her artistry lives on in her films, and always will. For years, Hollywood's tried to find the next Marilyn Monroe, but it's always been a fool's errand. There's never been anyone like her. And there never will be.
Do I feel happy in life? Let's say I hope I'm finding happiness, right? Well, for me, if I can realize certain things in my work, I come the closest to being happy. And I can say that also about my life. Well, it only happens, I think, in moments, sometimes when I'm working, and I'll be able to fulfill a scene truthfully. And then I think I'm the happiest.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Even the Rich ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today, or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. This is the final episode of our four-part series, Marilyn. If you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline can be reached at 1-800-273-8255. The National Alliance on Mental Illness is available at 1-800-950-6264. On our next episode, we'll be joined by Angelica Jade Bastian to discuss why she thinks Marilyn would have gotten behind the Me Too movement 70 years ago, how she shows us what this country has always gotten wrong when it comes to mental health, gender, and race, plus some of Marilyn Monroe's greatest on-screen moments. I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams. Dennis Hensley wrote this episode. It was edited by Allison Reimer, with additional editing by Julia Wolf. Kate Young is our producer. Our senior producers are Natalie Shisha and Ben Gray. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design is by Sam Ada. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.